With threats to our nation waiting around every corner, adaptability is more important than ever. When conditions change without notice, quick strategic thinking is crucial. And with obstacles consistently impending, determination is essential in overcoming them. It's this willingness, decisiveness, and resilience that sets Marines apart. With our fighting spirit, we don't just fight battles, we win them. Marines are the constant our nation counts on to fight the unknown. And through adaptable problem solving, we do just that. Learn more at marines.com.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Okay, round two. Name something that's not boring.
A laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah, oh, sorry. We were looking for Chumba Casino. That's right. Chumbacasino.com has over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Welcome to the latest episode of the Brighton Rock Podcast, the podcast about the beautiful club within the beautiful game. I'm at a noisy pub in London, just introducing this episode where we have footage, a little bit of audio from the weekend away at Accrington and Morecambe with Peter and I, then a very brief chat from Harrogate, Peter and I again trying to ground tick, this time unsuccessfully. And then, finally, but in the most part, it is an interview with Chris and Janet Jonas. Chris is chairman of Seagulls Over London. Chris and Janet went over to Qatar for the World Cup. We'll be chatting to them about their experiences on and off the pitch. Well, they weren't on the pitch, literally, of course, but you know what I mean. So, settle back, listen in for our latest episode. It's been the first one for a while, and enjoy. Right, Peter, it's the latest episode of the podcast, and here we are on the second ground of our weekend trip to the North West.
Odyssey.
At Odyssey.
That's odd.
To tick off a couple more grounds. Yesterday, Friday, we went to Morecambe to watch them bore out a 1-1 with Exeter, which was a bit boring, wasn't it?
Yeah, it wasn't a great second half, actually.
Quite a nice little ground, but not a great game.
Jensen Weir didn't really get in the game, which was a shame. We were hoping he'd score a last-minute winner.
Yeah, and it was ground number 87 for both of us. One slight difference between the two of us in terms of wear, but apart from that, we're on course to tick it all off at the same time. So ground 87, and today we're at Accrington Stanley. Do not say that.
No,
don't say it. Accrington Stanley, the crown ground.
By Accrington, but I'm not going to say it.
The crown ground, also known as the Wham Stadium at the moment, which I think is a sponsorship by the owner, if I'm not mistaken, something along those lines.
Not by George Michael.
No. So ground number 88 for both of us. We also bumped into Tony and Kirsty, friends of the show and Seagulls Over London members. Tony is actually making it 92 today, and Kirsty is making it 91. We'll hopefully catch up with them a little bit later on if we find them. But in the meantime, what did you make of Morecambe overall?
Yeah, it wasn't the place or the fact that it wasn't a great game.
We didn't see much of the town.
We saw it in the dark and by car on a grand tour. But yeah, it wasn't the greatest game ever. It was a decent first half and then a couple of goals, and then second half it went downhill. Extra and all the possession, really. You can see why Morecambe were struggling. You could tell that one team was better. Extra just couldn't finish, really.
Yeah.
That was the main difference.
And then today, same division, similar type of scenario. We've got Accrington Stanley, another team playing in red, northwest side, against Oxford. What are you thinking for today? This could be a more entertaining game, actually.
Could be, yeah.
It's got a bit more of a fun vibe as well with this ground, isn't it, I think?
Yeah, we're currently enjoying a pint of Aki Ale, which is...
The something brewery, can't remember what it was.
Boland Brewery,
yeah.
Which is
all right.
Obviously for saddos like us, was something we couldn't possibly turn down.
Ticking off a new beer as well.
And it's called Aki Ale, let's say.
Aki Ale, brilliant. You've got to do that when there is one.
There's also Aki Lager as well.
Yeah. And I've had a steak and pepper pie, which is decent. Not too bad at all. And in the background, we've got Celeste playing, so there's a bit of a Brighton link going on there. Oxford's still 1-0 up, Peter. 73 and a half minutes into this exhilarating encounter. Aki not looking that great. They just had a bit of a chance, but nothing came of it, did it?
Yeah, it's not looking good for my predictions for this week of Accrington and Morecambe. Like 1 point between them so far.
Oh dear. Anyway, there's still time. It's about probably 20 minutes of news.
It takes a second to score a goal.
Oh, please show the play. Success at last.
What a goal.
Fantastic equaliser. Driven left foot shot from who knows how far out. 25, 30 yards. Actually, it's brilliant. Bottom corner.
One.
Ethan, that's the
story,
whoever that was.
Yeah, Ethan
Dudley,
rather.
Yeah, who cares? 1-1, what a great goal. From a game that hasn't been great, hasn't been, to be honest.
Yeah, okay. And he had just come out of previously, the guy just made a shot from that edge of the area, which went backwards.
Yeah.
So he obviously thought he'd done really well there, so he's going to try again.
Yeah, yeah. Decent effort, I think, a couple of minutes beforehand as well, so it felt like it was coming. There it is, brilliant. And I are in Harrogate drinking loads of drinks and enjoying ourselves, aren't we, Peter?
Speak for yourself, I've been having like lots of water.
Yeah, maybe not. But it's been a wonderful weekend, despite the fact having ticked off a couple of grounds last weekend. We stayed in Lancaster, we ticked off Morecambe on Friday night, we ticked off Accrington on Saturday afternoon. And the following weekend, we came up to Harrogate, and we had a lovely time.
It's harrowing.
Except for the fact there was no game, because it was a frozen pitch. So we're still on 88 out of 92. Yeah. But it's been great, hasn't it? Good fun.
It's been a very fun day, barring also watching England lose as well.
Yeah. Yes, we're speaking on the Saturday night now.
Sunday morning, technically.
Sunday morning, yeah. And we've been ripped off, and we've been knocked out of the World Cup.
And we've been thrown up Harrogate.
Discuss, as we walk out the door. As we walk out of this lovely brewing establishment, discuss why and how we got knocked out.
By cheating referees and general cheating Frenchmen, basically.
Cheating Frenchmen. It sounds very sinister. That was a plot.
I mean, it was.
Yeah.
It was FIFA's plot led by Infantino and his cronies to knock us out.
Well,
and the referee, obviously, as well.
Last time we did a podcast, we were still in the group stages, and we got through them. We beat Senegal very comfortably, 3-0.
Yeah.
We've scored, what is it, 12 goals, is it? Conceded only 2. 3 clean sheets in a row. Played France. Always going to be tough, and it turned out...
They had 13 men.
13 men, yeah.
And 16. Actually, how many VAR men can I have been played so far?
Yeah, there's all that. And, well, talk us through the disappointment.
I mean, it pales in comparison compared to cheating we've got against Villa, so, you know, I'm going to get over it within about a day or so, whereas like, Villa, I'm still not over.
Glad you got a dig in about Villa there, very good.
Yeah,
nice.
Cheating Villa.
And what were the particular incidents?
Well, obviously, the first goal was an absolute travesty.
Yep. A foul on Saka.
Yeah, clear foul on Saka that even a blind man could have seen.
Straight to the other end, and there's a goal.
Yeah. So, you know, and yeah. It took a while, apparently, to get up there, 45 seconds, whatever, but apparently that means that VAR can't get involved, or it wasn't a fair and obvious error. So, first incident didn't go for our favour. Yep. Then, what looked like a penalty on Kane, but might have been just outside the area, but we didn't get a free kick in the end for it, so.
Or a clear view, indeed.
Yeah. So, quite irritating. And then, then we come back second half, blatant penalty, got it, scored. France then get an absolutely massive deflection, fortunate goal.
And then we get
a penalty, which Kane misses. Hernandez should have been sent off because he should have been booked a long time before, after, like, basically hauling back Saka, and then should have been booked again, which he was, for the penalty incident.
Yeah.
And the referee was basically... Well, apparently, it's like Wikipedia has an interesting review of him.
Yeah, I think so. They were changeable by the minute, weren't they? Nothing to do with England fans, I'm sure.
No, I'm sure they were. No. I'm sure it's all Frenchmen.
And the semi-finals now, it's Argentina against Croatia, who knocked out Brazil on penalties. And obviously, we've got Morocco... who've knocked out Spain, which is incredible. I called it. I knew it was going to happen. It did happen. They're playing now. They play Portugal, and they knocked out Portugal in the quarterfinals.
Which led to my favourite moment of the World Cup, Ronaldo crying.
And in his typical graceless and classless way, he strutted straight off the pitch. He didn't console his younger teammates. That's the way to act with class.
So my favourite now, my hope for the World Cup now is Argentina, McAllister. I want Messi to then prove once for all he's better than Ronaldo. My second choice is anyone but France.
So you like Argentina to beat Portugal or France in the final?
No, in Morocco or France.
Or Morocco. Sorry, yes, Morocco or France, yeah, in the final. And
I want a Brighton player to have won the World Cup now. That's like my name.
Got this vision. I've had it for a couple
of
rounds.
Even though it probably means he won't play Southampton game.
No, but I've had a couple of rounds of games thinking and having this vision that McAllister is going to have a very significant part to play.
Good or bad?
In the final. No, good. A good bet. In the final. I think he will be involved in the winning goal or winning penalty if it's a shootout in the final. I think Argentina will get there. I think they'll win it. And I think he'll be involved. Even if it's off the bench.
Well, he won't be off the bench. I think he's pretty much a permanent starter.
Yeah, he probably will start, yeah.
He's started every game they've won, and he's not started every game they've lost. So, I mean, not played every game they've lost. So it seems a bit of a no-brainer to keep him in the team.
McAllister.
Ali Mack.
Yeah. So, it's been interesting.
Not till next Wednesday, at least.
And there's been so many twists and turns, hasn't there, along the way.
He's also been talked about quite a lot. He's such a good player for us.
Yeah, so glad he got that contract signed.
Yeah, that was a very big thing.
Mitoma, mainly off the bench, was coming on. He was making an impression. Japan were great, and then they just were so shit at penalties, weren't they? They made us look good at penalties. It was that bad. And then Spain
made them
look good. They were even worse. They lost 3-0 on penalties in a shootout.
Anyone who's a listener wants to know, write in. Has there ever been a 0-0 draw after 5 penalties? That would be brilliant to know.
Exactly. The highlights of this tournament, and there are highlights, they are in there. Morocco, their continued voyage. Japan in general was great. And there's been some happy moments in general. The downside? Well, we've had a British journalist.
An upside was Qatar getting thrashed or getting beaten by the AV team and getting the worst group record ever.
Yeah, the first host nation. I think it might be to not win any of the games, but definitely not to get any points.
And they got no points at all.
Which is brilliant.
I think it's not to win the games at all.
That was brilliant. It's also been a tournament where we've had Iranian, the Iran thing is off the scale.
Yeah.
Iran has been, I mean, you've had people, as Amir we had on the podcast, saying about how people were monitoring for the government. Yeah. They were monitoring the players and fans. There was watchers in the crowd on the streets with binoculars who were scanning Iranian citizens, looking for people they could identify and use information on should they ever be in or returning back to Iran.
Yeah, it's
disgraceful. It's a disgrace. It's a disgrace. People have been gunning down in the streets here over this. It's just a disgrace. And yet, you've got a feel for the Iranians. It's a real in between two points situation, isn't it? Because they want to create a lot of. Oh, there's another path that might be open. That's the one I was talking about, Starling. Nice place in Harrogate. Check that one out, Peter, later on. But anyway, you want to flag up all the issues, and I think being at the World Cup does do that.
Okay.
It does do that. But also at the same time, it does flag up the issues, but at the same time it does also cause a fractious
issues back home.
Yeah, because what's happening is you've got a nation that's being represented by a team, and that team doesn't want to represent the regime.
Yeah.
The fans don't want it to represent the regime, and they're caught between a rock and a hard place because they're not singing the national anthem. They're then getting threatened with all sorts of punishments or threats to their family by not singing the national anthem. It's crazy stuff. Horrendous times. So we've had all that. But overall though, Peter, what's your take on this World Cup on the pitch? What's your thoughts on
it? It's been very entertaining in a lot of ways. There's been a lot of interesting games, a lot of stuff going on off the pitch. it's a disgrace the way Qatar government and the Qatari, the way they behave has been disgraceful. Things that, you know, if they brought up things like alcohol before the tournament, like when he first brought it off, then it would be fine. Similarly, if they'd applied on basically the December, November tournament, it would be fine. But they basically ripped everyone off and then
Also, by the way,
hang your head in shame.
If you're listening,
they're talking about having an Olympic bid for 2036. The IOC, if you ever go anywhere near that place, an Olympic host, then you should be shot.
Sporting morals are redundant. Yeah. So anything is doable now, to be honest. As you're probably hearing, as we walk through the streets of Harrogate,
the busy part of Harrogate,
we've definitely found the lively part, haven't we? Not that we haven't had a bit of a lively night already tonight.
Apparently, Duke's well out for passing, but we want to go home now.
Duke is the dog, by the way, in case anyone's wondering.
Duke's well out for a party time, you know.
I mean, he's got a Christmas jumper on, I've got a Christmas jumper on. It's a festive period, we're moving into it now. We're starting our festivities
tonight.
We're
not far from Albion being back.
Exactly, yeah.
A week and a half from party time in Charlton.
It's the World Cup, it's Christmas, Peter.
Huge, obviously.
What we're doing, we're just doing a brief one today. Essentially, the plan is we are having a chat with the Proud Seagulls. I think that will be the next podcast. It's going to be very interesting to hear their views on Qatar. I think we can guess a number of them already, but to hear their views on Qatar is going to be interesting.
Not positive?
No. exactly, yeah. It's going to be interesting, shall we say.
On a turnaround from that, do you have any views on people drinking Leeds United beers?
I knew this was coming up. Right, we've been out and about, we've had a load of drinks. I must have had about 30 or 40 different drinks over the weekend.
I've not had anywhere near
that. This is thirds, mainly in thirds, by the way. I'm not drinking that much, by the way.
30 pints.
But I did indulge in a Leeds United. It was what was it called? What was the exact name of it?
I ditched the name from my memory. You're the one who drank
something.
It.
Something times IBUs times Leeds United, and the actual brew was called the Square Ball, which is the name of Leeds United fanzine, so it's a collaborative thing. And yes, I did was have a sip of your wife's beer, rated it on Untappd, and apparently I've turned into this pariah figure.
Yes, pariah's the right word.
You didn't have it, of course, because you hate Leeds so much. You can't drink a decent beer, even if it's got a bad name.
Well, there's a lot of other decent beers that don't have a bad name.
Well, that's true, yeah.
If it was the only decent beer in the whole place, I probably would have done. But
I had to have it just to annoy you, and it's worked.
It's worked really well, yeah. I thought I knew you.
I can't remember what else has happened. There's been so many things to discuss. We'll probably have to catch up with a load of other stuff later. Yeah, we've missed out on the bloody the Harrogate game, so we're still on 88 out of 92. Yeah. So, we've both got Harrogate to do, we've both got Fleetwood to do, we've both got Barrow to do, and my fourth one is Salford, yours is Wimbledon.
Yeah.
It may take us into next
season.
We're
doing better than Duke, though.
We'll get there in the end.
Duke's got 92 to do.
Duke the dog has 92.
He's not going to do very well.
So he's not been to any grounds.
No.
Right, yeah, he might be out of the equation, to be honest.
I think he'll get there before us.
I don't think he will, no.
He does look like he's determined now, though, he might do.
There has been an upsurge in the interest in a load of people we know in ticking off the 92. We have Chris and Janet.
This weekend was actually a huge blow for us.
It was a huge blow. Chris and Janet, friends of the show. Seagulls Over London members. Chris is the chairman of Seagulls Over London. They're England fans. They're over in Qatar. We're hoping to get them on the podcast to talk about the World Cup and their experiences over there. Good, bad and ugly.
They won't be hyping the good.
No. But Chris is going to tick off Fleetwood on FA Cup third round day. That's going to be 92 for him. Tony Brown, who joined us in going to Morecambe on the Friday and Accrington on the Saturday afternoon.
Accrington,
last
Saturday.
Weekend.
Who were they?
Don't do it. Stop it. Tony and Kirsty, they went to both those games last weekend, same as us. It was Tony's 91st and 92nd grounds. Kirsty's on 91. Tony has completed for 92. Can we just say congratulations to him?
Congratulations.
What an achievement.
Yeah, you're well ahead of Duke.
Yeah, very well ahead of Duke. And Chris, if he does do the 7th of January thing, he will complete his 92. So a big up to those guys. A number of other people, friends of the show, are very close, or they're getting all the more interested in ticking off grounds. It's become a thing amongst us Albion fans, hasn't it?
Well, it's obviously with the World Cup, it's been quite an opportunity. Sadly, today wasn't to be, but...
Yeah. It's an excuse to come back to a very, very good town. Harrogate is a lovely place.
Great place. Good pubs.
Friendly people, great shops, great beers, great pubs, and...
Some average company.
I'd say the same, actually, yeah. But apart from that, it's been good. The local people are friendly.
Yeah.
We had the Christmas markets, of course. So it was a good weekend to have a cancelled, postponed fixture, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was. Yeah, it's much better than having it last weekend when we've had to go back separate times to Malcolm Eccles.
We based ourselves in Lancaster. I caught up with some old friends of mine, James and Sarah, in Lancaster. We stayed there, didn't we? In that city.
We went back there for Fleetwood and Barrow. So.
Yeah. So. There's always a quest, there's always a plan, there's always a future thing to go for. But in the meantime, Peter, any further thoughts on the World Cup or the football world in general over the last, week or two?
I can't wait for Albion to come back now.
Yeah, most of them
are back. I can't wait to be at Charleston in a week and a half, and then Southampton 2 weeks tomorrow. I think
We've got to mention the World Cup. Yes, we've had, I think we've only had 5 people, is it, have represented the Albion as current players at the World Cup in the future, in the past ever.
In the future.
in the past. And with this very tournament, we've not only equaled that on its own, but we've actually had 8 in one tournament. 3 of them at Ecuador, of course.
One of whom's got semi-finals, so...
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm throwing my weight behind Ali Mack and Lionel Messi.
Yeah.
Not going to help them anyway whatsoever, but...
McAllister, he's still there. He's still in the tournament. Semi-final level. The 3 Ecuadorian lads, Caicedo, Estupina, and Sarmiento are all out. Itama is out. Terrible penalty in the shootout, by the way. Who else is out?
Confident.
Sanchez is out. Spain was surprised. They are out. Obviously Ghana, Lamptey, yeah, he's out. And we are down to just one. Who else has missed? Is there someone else I've missed out? There's probably someone else.
I think there was, but I can't remember.
People are screaming at their phones now. But essentially, 7 out of 8 are out. Alexis McAllister with Argentina goes into the semi-finals.
Trossard.
Trossard's the one, yeah. They should have played Trossard more. But they didn't.
They didn't see the Hazard coming.
Ali Mack is the last man standing, and I've got a vision of him doing something in the final. We'll see if it happens.
We don't know what you're on, though, to be fair.
One way or the other. It's been brilliant for him. It's been great for the Albion. Lots of publicity, of mentions of the club.
He's literally played every game that they've won and not played every game they've lost.
Yeah.
I mean, what's that say?
Yeah. The downside,
He's in the final.
Well, I was going to say the downsides are Welsh fans with bucket hats with rainbows on have been banned. A journalist with a rainbow T-shirt has been banned.
And
a journalist with a mask has been banned. As you said, the rainbow T-shirt guy, American journalist, 48 years old, has actually died, apparently of a heart attack or heart failure related.
Apparently a lot of Qatari, the migrant workers also died of as well, so we can believe that or not.
Yeah, let's just say... We don't know what happened. He looks very healthy from the photos I've seen. Whatever's happened there, it may genuinely be a thing, but...
It seems suspicious that it's one person, one journalist who had a rainbow T-shirt suddenly...
And spoke out a lot.
Yeah.
Are we being a bit too cynical there, Peter?
Well, no, because journalists haven't died at previous World Cups, so it's a funny coincidence.
Yeah. Dare we say, who knows? You know, we'll leave that one lingering. So that was me and Peter from the Harrogate game. Didn't tick off our grounds, but we did have a lovely weekend. Unfortunately, of course, that did include seeing England get knocked out. Well, we move on to the final part, the main part of this podcast, which is to welcome for, I think it's their debut, unless you've had a very brief...
I've been on.
You've been on, haven't you, Chris? Yeah, you've been on before, yeah. I want to welcome you in full entirety. We have Mr. Chris Jonas and Mrs. Janet Jonas. Welcome to the podcast, folks. How are you?
Hi, good.
Very good, thanks, Russ.
Thank you. Great to have you both with us. And you have just arrived back home because you, as well as being avid Albion fans and Seagulls Over London members, and in fact, Chris, you are the chairman now of Seagulls Over London for the last, what is it, a year or so, is it now?
Yeah, 6 months, maybe.
6 months, yeah. You're also avid England fans and you travel home and away to both the Albion and for England games, both of you. You've just got back, so I want to hear all about Qatar and what it was like. As you guys know, I've been quite dissenting of it being a location to host the tournament. But there's been a lot of fuss around the tournament itself. But I want to get into the nitty-gritty of what it was like. So we'll come to that in a second. But first of all, disappointment with England, of course, getting knocked out. Semi-finals we couldn't quite make this year. Europe, all of the England games, I assume.
Yeah, and we went to all... Yeah.
Well, I'll ask you about that in a moment. But what was your overall experience then of Qatar? The good, the bad, and the ugly. Talk us through it, guys.
Well, in terms of it was a great holiday. So we were away for 4 weeks, 28 days. In fact, we left on middle of November and got back in the middle of December only back yesterday. So it was a fantastic 4 week trip. We had some winter sunshine when it was cold and damp here. So we had a brilliant time. We went to 5 countries, 2 new countries, and we had some good friends who are also England fans, traveled around with us. So in that sense, it was a really nice holiday, of which football was slightly incidental really, but, yeah, we enjoyed it.
Yeah, and you bumped into a couple of Seagulls Over London members as well, I think, over there, calling to pictures.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, there's a couple of other members there. So there was Nigel and...
Nick. And Neil.
Yeah, Nick stroke Nigel.
Oh, yes.
I'm not quite sure what his official name is. And Neil we met, who very kindly let us leave our bags at his house at one day at his apartment. We also saw Paul Camlin, who's obviously one of the Brighton media director, and Derek Chapman, who's one of the Brighton directors there as well, who were both there as fans in fan capacity rather than any official capacity. So we had a good chat with them as well, which was nice.
Yeah, and Paul is an avid Dingle fan. I think you see him quite a bit on away days, don't you, Paul Camlin?
Yeah, Paul Camlin is a fan like us. He's a top capper. That means he's been to every game like us. So we see him quite often. We bump into him. For the first time, actually, we did arrange to meet up with him, and we actually went for a very nice lunch when Jeff and Kat, also Seagulls Over London members, our children, were there. And so the five of us went for a very nice lunch in the souk in Doha.
Yeah, brilliant. You mentioned 5 countries and 2 new ones. So you were, obviously the whole tournament was located in Qatar. A lot of people were living for the period of time of the tournament elsewhere and travelling in. Is that, I presume that's the case with you guys, wasn't it?
Yeah.
We stayed in Qatar, you know, on several occasions, sort of, the games, but also for longer periods. But we did make a decision to take the opportunity to visit other places in the region while we were there, just expand the sightseeing, but also, because the accommodation everywhere else was considerably cheaper and often better quality. So there was a kind of a balance. And I think, you know, within Qatar, there is a limited amount of sightseeing opportunities as well. So I think it very much needed other activities. If you were going to go to every England game over a 1 month period, it was good to be able to visit elsewhere to, you know, get some more stimulation, really.
Yeah, it's often cheaper for us to get a flight out and then stay in a sensibly priced hotel somewhere else.
For 3 or 4 days.
And then come back again. Mm. But we did spend quite a lot of time in Qatar, and we spent enough time there to get a feel for what it was like. Mm. So I think we did a bit. The 5 countries we went to, obviously Qatar, we went to Saudi Arabia, to Jeddah, which was an interesting experience. Then on to Kuwait. Which again surprised us. I thought it was going to be smarter. It was quite scruffy. You think with their wealth that it would have been smarter. To Oman, which we've been to before, which we do like and would be a great place for a winter sunshine holiday, but for anyone who fancies that, very neat, tidy, friendly. and more relaxed on the alcohol.
And a lot to see.
And a lot to see. Some good history, some good cities in the interior and some landscapes. And then finally we had a few days in Cairo in Egypt, which we have been to before, but, you know, absolutely fantastic to see the pyramids again, and to see Tutankhamun and the mask, which I think I saw as a schoolboy when I was about 12. So to see it a second time.
And a total contrast to Qatar as well, you know, very different ends of the spectrum in terms of, you know, noise and bustle and, you know, everything.
In terms of Qatar itself, it is one city, really. It's one country with one city, which is Doha. And it's the capital on the eastern coast. And there's not a lot of accommodation there. And FIFA sort of took a cartel over all the accommodations. So that did cause issues that it was hard to book the accommodation. The accommodation was expensive and it was totally inflexible. So you couldn't cancel it if England were knocked out. If you booked it, you couldn't cancel it and get your money back. So that made it very different from other World Cups that we've been to, where there's other towns and cities you can drive in on the day and there'll be a multitude of options. So that was a downside, was the price of accommodation, the inflexibility of the accommodation and the limited amount of accommodation. And that's again why we moved in and out. In terms of Qatar, the people were fantastic. Everyone was friendly. I don't know that we ever spoke to a local Qatari, but we spoke to a lot of locals who were a lot of the sort of immigrant workers who were there, and they were brilliant. They loved football. They loved England. If you got on the metro, they got up. But every time, it made me feel old because everyone got up for me and then they get up for Janet. So, you know, everyone was just so polite. They give you directions. They spoke English very well.
Really enthusiastic.
Yeah, so in that sense, it was lovely. You know, there's a couple of excellent museums in Qatar. The National Museum is well worth a visit for anyone who wants to go and see that. Very modern. And the sports museum that we went to, the 3-2-1 Sports and Olympic Museum, to use its title, was actually very surprisingly good. So there was a couple of good things there. But then once you've done that, that's it. Yeah. You know, what else do you do? We walked the Corniche, which is about 3 miles long and a bit barren, really, but a lovely arc around the bay.
Yeah.
So that was nice. And that was it. We did hire a car for a couple of days and we drove out to the east coast. West coast, sorry. But there's nothing there. You know, they've sort of scouted the land for building materials and there's a 5-lane each way highway out to nowhere on the east coast. Yeah. And they built the infrastructure, but there's nothing there. And
a few people.
Yeah. So then you get to the east coast and the beaches were barren. There was no resorts or anything there. One was a sort of Qatar Energy City work town. And the highlight was the McDonald's. And that was it. Seriously was it. And so, yeah, other than Doha, there was nothing else. We did see some wild camels. That was quite interesting. So at least we saw that. But, you know, once you're out of the town, there isn't really much else to Qatar.
Yeah. Listening to some of the podcasts from the, you know, on the national scale, journalists that are over there, I think one or two of them took wrong directions. And it was only when they're going in the wrong way for long enough, probably on the road you mentioned, they realised they were just seeing more and more barren landscape and just camels, wild camels.
Yeah.
I think we've taken the wrong turn here, boys. Yeah. So there's a bit of that going on. It sounds as if everything's very pristine, very well organised. I know obviously the thing about alcohol was it was all to do with in confined areas, behind closed doors, essentially, wasn't it? Or in the fan box. I'm presuming you didn't go to the fan box on account of the fact there's so many games to catch in a short period. Well,
we went there on the last day just to, so that we could see it.
The day of the semi-final.
So that people wanted to talk about the fan park. Yeah, it was there, the semi-final. We were flying home that night and we could actually say we'd been there and we'd seen it. And to be honest, it was a waste of time. The security to get in it was horrendous. So they took the water off me, my water bottle. They took two pens, biros, out off Janet. And the kid in front of us, they took their sweets off them. And so you can't go in with sweets. You've got to eat them outside. And this was sort of military-level security.
It was more security in the fan part than there was into the stadium. For the stadium, it was appropriate, the security. For the fan part, it was ridiculous.
So this was just at the fan part, this, all this security confiscation.
Well, the security was quite heavy. I mean, and, you know, we went to Euro 2020 final.
Yeah.
In 21 at Wembley, which was absolutely the worst game in the several thousand games I've been in. So, you know, the security of that is what we should have had at Wembley. The security, yeah, I thought was fine. It was appropriate. It was lots of people, but light-handed, and everyone again was smiley and friendly, as they were at the fan park. But you know, you don't need to be taking sweets off the kids in front of their snacks and chocolate and stuff. And then when you get in, there really wasn't anything in there. There was a big stand, a big screen where they were playing DJ sets and songs with some quite strong swear words, which I won't repeat on here, but it surprises. No alcohol, but lots of swear words.
Lots of smoking.
And the other thing, we can talk more about the beer and stuff and the situation with alcohol, but, you know, they ban that, but everyone smokes. So, which I think is probably worse for my health, as I don't smoke, and probably worse for their health than alcohol.
Yeah, I guess it's centred around behaviour. And I know in a couple of messages you put on the Seagulls Over London WhatsApp, you're describing the the fan experience in terms of, obviously there's no major scale alcohol drinking going on, and therefore behaviour is changed, which is maybe the one good thing from that is you avoid the more rowdy, shall we say, out of hand behaviour by a number of groups of fans, England not least, we have to say, amongst those that do tend to get into that. And you said that was noticeable by its absence because of, I guess partly the cost of getting over there was more than average, and also the fact that people weren't going to be able to drink and have a normal, whatever you might call a normal tournament fan experience. Would you say that was the case, and could you expand on those elements, guys?
Well, I think there was no kind of happy medium in terms of atmosphere and alcohol. So, I mean, you know, first on the alcohol, there's a bit of double standards going on here, in that you can drink alcohol in the more upscale, hotels and, you know, with bars, but also people with licenses can have alcohol in their apartments as well. And that wasn't very commonly known, but there was no shortage of alcohol for members of the media in the apartments they're staying in. And then at the stadia, but also in fan parks in designated areas, there's hospitality areas, which are, you know, expensive and limited in who can come in. And apparently it's okay for them to drink, you know, including right before the match. But it's not okay for the rank and file, in case the rest of the population are exposed to, you know, scenes of people drinking. So there's no happy medium. You can go to a restaurant and have a bottle of wine or a couple of beers, you know, before or after the game. So, and I think then in terms of, you know, fan experiences, I think there are a lot of nations where alcohol isn't a big thing. So most, you know, Islamic countries were, you know, their behaviour was perfectly normal and, you know, involved a lot of cheering and whistling and dancing. And so, you know, they were perfectly upbeat and happy. But I think it did sort of flatten the sort of fan behaviour and experience, you know, particularly of the Northern European nations, perhaps some of the South American teams.
I think the numbers of England fans were significantly down. It wasn't that great in Russia 4 years earlier, and there weren't significant numbers. Less than 3,000, I think, was the number that was quoted. And there were some comments on various England fans groups, a bit like our Seagulls Over London groups that we're members of, saying there was too many middle-aged couples on holiday there, which we think was probably a dig at us. Fortunately, we were slightly older than the age group they were having a dig at. And there were a lot of middle-aged couples there. And we're the sort of people that can take time off just before Christmas. Because we're spending our kids' inheritance, we can actually decide that we can afford it. And both of us are retired. So, you know, we were there on holiday, and there were people like us. And the younger drinking crowd weren't there in the numbers that they would do. And the other thing that slightly counted against us, and it was for TV really, is that we had four of our games were at 10 o'clock in the evening, kickoff time, local time. And three of them were at the stadium out back, which is the most distant from the centre of Doha. So it took 2 hours to get there. And it was all very easy to get there. You just got on the metro and then one of the thousands of shuttle buses. So there's no complication in getting there.
Or difficulty.
Yeah, and so you just followed the crowds, really. And so that was easy and incredibly well organised. But it meant you had to get there 2 hours to make sure you got through the security and got your tickets done. We were typically getting to the grounds 4.5 hours early. I mean, anyone who'd been drinking in Doha was totally sober by the time they got to the ground some 4 hours later. And you couldn't get ground beer at the ground, which I thought was a real act of bad faith.
Mm.
You know,
especially for that, when people have travelled for a while without drinking anyway. It's not as if they're going to be...
And canceling it just 2 days before, I think it was mis-selling, really. I think that FIFA or Qatar authorities, whether they knew they were going to do that and just withdraw it 2 days before, I think that was a total act of bad faith.
Yeah.
So it did mean, though, that you couldn't drink at the stadium. And by the time you get to the stadium, anyone who had been drinking was thoroughly sobered up because it was just, you got there so early and so long.
As you've said before, by the time you get back from the stadium as well, everything's closed. So you can't even have a drink or much of a drink when you get back.
That's it. I mean, none of our games went to added time, extra time or penalties, but they all finished at midnight. And then the 2 hours to get back to your place, so you're well after 2 o'clock in the morning.
You're going to bed anyway then, don't you?
They shut by 3 mostly, don't they?
But of course you can't.
Orders at 2.
There's no off licenses and stuff. You can't have a beer in your room because that's not allowed.
You can't even walk from, you know, the bar with a glass in your hand to go to anywhere else in the hotel. So you can't even, you know, walk with a pint of beer from the bar back to your room.
Because so will you stop from doing
other people to the sight of you with alcohol?
So in that sense, it's probably healthy for us because we drank less than we would have done. You know, had it been a normal sort of football trip, we would have drunk more. I mean, we drink, as you know, but we don't drink to excess. But that was a downer. The atmosphere at the stadiums was definitely quieter. I think I said on the WhatsApp group that, you know, for the France game, which is our most important game for many years, the quarter final of the World Cup, you could hear the players on the pitch shouting to each other. It was like being at a non-league game.
At times.
So it was good that, you know, you go to the loo at half time. There's no rush for the loo because no one's been drinking. They don't need to go like they do at home.
And the stadium facilities are absolutely fantastic.
Yeah.
Everything's spotlessly clean.
And everyone's really polite. No one's barging into you.
Plenty of people cleaning up.
Yeah, someone actually spilled a can of Coke just in front of us. And within 2 minutes, they'd come and mopped it up. You imagine that at Wembley.
Yeah. I can only imagine.
Yeah. So, It was a strange atmosphere. Everyone was polite. Everyone was friendly. But then there was a lack of singing and a lack of atmosphere, I felt.
And I think that's not just down to alcohol. It's also, I think, down to the numbers of England fans the fans that weren't there. And, you know, there probably were a number of reasons that led people to decide to give this tournament a swerve, not least the expense, but also the complexity of the arrangements to get there. Yeah. It was not customer friendly.
Yeah, you had to get the hire card, which is effectively their visa. And that was a complex, torturous process to get it. But once you got it, it was fantastic because that then gave you easy access to the stadium, easy access to the free access to all the transport, metro, trains, trams, whatever. And easy access through the airport. And again, there were some good things, you know, that the metro was good. The taxis were cheap and plentiful. And getting through Hamad International Airport in Doha was a breeze. You just walked out through the E-gate and out the other side.
Yeah.
And the same in and out, you know, so that was a breeze. The only time I had to stop because the E-gate wouldn't work was at Gatwick when we got home yesterday.
all the flights were on time, you know, all the arrangements were fantastic. And it really was, you know, if you compare it to the usual experience in the UK recently, it was head and shoulders better than anything, you know, we've had of late in the UK.
Another good thing, I mean, the food in the restaurants was good. So you could go up market. We did eat in a smart restaurant with our friends early on in Nobu, which was brilliant, but not cheap. But then most of the time we ate locally. And you could go into a local restaurant and everyone was so charming to us, friendly, didn't necessarily speak perfect English, but, you know, you sort of all muddled through with a big smile and pat on the back. And the food was cheaper than at home. And it was lovely. Chicken, kebabs, rice, chips, whatever, salad. And so that side of it was brilliant. We loved all that. Just no beer with it.
Yeah. Well, in terms of cuisine, you mentioned sort of kebabs and various things. Is there a particular cuisine distinct for Qatar? Because I'm not aware of what particularly, is it just sort of a generic kind
it's
of...
Very, Middle Eastern influence, but also it's had a big trading position historically. So originally it was very important for pearling, and it had trade routes with India, the Levant, but also Africa. And so the cuisine is influenced by that. So, you know, apart from sort of typical Middle Eastern dishes and a lot of rice, with different kinds of grilled meat and whatever, you can get a lot of Indian food, Persian food, Turkish food. So it's quite varied.
Everywhere you went, they had hummus and multiple lentil stacks soup. Of bread. Yeah, hummus and bread was a big thing.
Fettuccine salad's my favourite.
But the other thing is, which we're not that keen on, is there was big shopping malls in virtually every city that we went to, not just in Doha, but the ones in Doha were incredible. So, you know, you can imagine Westfields out of Stratford or whatever, and then double that in size, and then have the number of restaurants. And so in those restaurants, there was restaurants from all over the world. So you could have pizza, you could have pasta, you could have Chinese, you could have Turkish. There was even fish and chip shops that called themselves British fish and chips. So
I'm just going to say, with the historical connections to England in the past, I wondered if there's going to be any fish and chips, meat and potato pies, or roast beef and all that sort of stuff.
Yeah, there was.
Certainly fish and chips.
Yeah. So you could get really any cuisine, but, you know, we wanted to try the local stuff. We tried the local restaurants, and it was good value and good food. Mm. And, you know, none of us, we've been away 4 weeks, none of us were ill at all. So that's brilliant.
So it's quite a relaxing experience, apart from the inflexibility of the tickets and some of the travel times and elements like that, obviously, and the drink. But other than that, generally, it sounds like a positive experience. I know everything seemed to be very clean, very efficient, very well organised.
Yeah.
You know, from that side of it, it's good to hear, certainly. I think there wasn't any kind of trouble or issues that been reported from, you know, from over here, hearing about it, with the exception of, I think, some ticketing issues for the Morocco, one of their games, I think it might have been against Spain, where I think people were ticketless trying to get in, Morocco fans, which caused some disturbance. I don't think it was anything bad going on, but other than just a general kerfuffle on quite a large scale. But I think that's the only issue. And I know there was a heavy police presence. Apparently loads of people farmed in from Turkey because they just don't have that sort of sizable security force. So apparently they had people in from Turkey to cover the potential for a complete inundation of Moroccan fans trying to get in for that semi-final.
I think if you were trying to jib your way in like they did at Wembley for the Euro 2020, you'd have to be incredibly optimistic because it was military level security.
Yeah.
I mean, the gates and everything, you had to get through about six different gates just to get in, and you had to have all the matching paperwork and tickets and everything. So to try that and bluff your way in, I think you had to be incredibly optimistic. It would have been great to see the crowd that did get into Wembley actually attempt it there and see what happened to them.
It was a it was really about three checks. There's one on the perimeter, and then as you approach the gate, you'd show the hire card and your ticket again, and you'd get it scanned, and then you would go through the turnstile and the security checks, and then later on you'd go to the turnstile, but you'd already been well checked by then.
Mm. And there was police and security everywhere, and they also brought in a lot of the Pakistan security forces as well.
Okay.
And they're all in the uniforms, but they're all incredibly charming. So you can walk 6 foot down the street and say hello to about three different security guards, private ones, imported ones, maybe some local ones as well. But they're all charming. They're all helpful. If you looked at your map or anything, people come and help. The security would come and help. You know, we even saw security guards making sure they got their Arab type dresses on straight. So, you know, people were actually, so the security was there and you didn't want to mess with it and you don't want to end up in a Qatari jail, I'm sure. But, you know, a lot of it, but very light handed.
Yeah. I don't know what you picked up on in terms of while you were over there in terms of reporting. There's a few things going on behind the scenes. Obviously people trying to wear rainbow bucket hats, particularly Wales fans. I think rainbow flags confiscated, various other things confiscated. I think you mentioned one of your Spurs supporting mates had an England flag with a Tottenham thing on that got confiscated because it had words on. Quite honestly, I agree with
that one. That was just to go into the museum before the first game. So, a couple of days before the first game. So they didn't want things with what they thought were slogans.
Yeah.
To be fair, I mean, on that Tottenham one, it was the first time, and it was actually going, the museum was inside the security of the ground, although it wasn't a match day on, so it was match day security.
Oh, yeah.
After that, they introduced a flag verification point. They took a picture of it and sent it to someone, maybe someone from the English FA, who approved it instantly or not. So everyone, I think, pretty much got their flags in that they wanted, unless it said something horrible.
Yeah.
In terms of the rainbow armbands and all that sort of stuff,
I think I saw quite a few rainbowy things around.
I saw a rainbow on one of the pictures, which is quite funny.
Yeah.
But I just feel these are tokens that we get upset about. You know, if we want to have a proper discussion about equality, about LGBT and stuff, we should have that. And it's not just Qatar that believes that. That is quite common in the Arab world. And, you know, 8 of the 32 countries there still have homosexuality as illegal. And so do we say, well, we're not going to Qatar because we don't like their views, and therefore none of the countries that go that have those views should play there either? In which case, we'd end up with a very small number of countries that would either play us or we want to play. So, you know, I think there's a lot of hypocrisy around this stuff. You know, clearly everyone is equal. We should all be treated equally, and, you know, everyone should have the right human rights and do what they like. But if they don't, does that stop us going there? You know, I don't believe, I'm not religious. I don't believe in any of the religions, but, you know, I go to a wedding or a christening or whatever to support the people that are going there. You know, you made a point on one of your pods, Russ, you know, how will we look back? We'll be ashamed that we all did this in 50 years time, but we shouldn't forget 56 years ago, England won the World Cup in England at Wembley, where homosexuality was illegal.
Absolutely.
So in 1966, in England, homosexuality was illegal.
Yeah,
but it is Qatar. Perhaps in 50 years, 56 years, perhaps things like this, things like this have actually improved the workers' lot. The terms and conditions of the workers have been improved. And maybe, you know, opening up the world like that, actually participating and having some dialogue and seeing what the rest of the world does, maybe in 56 years' time, you know, we go back to Qatar and it would have changed as it has in England.
Yeah, absolutely. Certainly time is a great element in this. You look at, someone was talking, I think it was Tim Vickery, the South American football pundit, who was talking about, the Suarez handball, and he didn't understand why there's such a big fuss about that with the Ghana game from a few years back. Because you said Jack Charlton handballed it at in the 1966 tournament, and it was just said, well, we had to do that, and the game just carried on. Yeah. So things have changed, perceptions do change. I do think, If it can help in any way in the future, even if there's a little bit of gristle and clashes, cultures going on here, if in the future it does help aid and improve matters for equality, then great. I do think it's a very odd anomaly in the history of the game, obviously, not only for the fact it's a single country of incredibly small size hosting, which is the first time it's been in the Arab world, first time it's been a winter tournament. There's been a lot of firsts in terms of the general structure and arrangement, as well as first on the pitch as well. It's going to be interesting to see how it's viewed over time. You're absolutely right about what you said there about homosexuality being banned at the time when the World Cup was on in England. Women's football banned for 50 years until the 70s, which is absolutely shameful. Admittedly, we've moved on from that, and we just hope other countries can move on where that is the same circumstance there.
A lot of the bans on homosexuality were actually introduced by European countries when the African and Arab countries were colonies of the European countries.
Yeah.
They just never rescinded them in the way.
Well, we mentioned England, Qatar background as well. Mm. You know, I wouldn't be surprised, I haven't looked into it, wouldn't be surprised if it was partly connected to our doings there.
Well, maybe, yeah.
Also, whilst the FA didn't support women's football for decades, a lot of other countries that we might consider to be less liberal did support women's football. So, you know, we're all different. And, you know, I think not all differences are wrong, but, you know, some you're clearly hoping for progress in some areas.
Yeah.
We can't say everybody should be exactly like us.
Yeah. The other thing with the migrant workers, you mentioned there, Chris, that there have been changes in conditions of there's a bit of improvement there for going forward. Hopefully that'll be the case now. There's been a lot of fuss about the numbers of people that died, and it's somewhere in between the two figures quoted, isn't it, really? The Guardian are having to go, when they did their report, were going from just general reports of deaths that weren't accounted for. Qataris have gone with a ludicrously small figure. Obviously the real figure will be somewhere in between. And that's all done. We won't talk about that anymore because we've already covered it on the pod. Unless you've got any particular views to add.
Well,
I'd just like to say something on this. I think terms of, deaths in industry or whatever, any death is wrong and absolutely, completely wrong. And we need to avoid that in every construction industry, every industry around the world. And clearly, CATSA standards weren't as good as they could have been, but they have certainly improved during the course of construction. And a lot of the kind of people that came in to help them build, stadia did insist on far higher safety standards, but also living standards for people that work there. So if that carries through and continues to improve, then you can say the World Cup has been a force for good in Qatar. And looking around, they were actually operating to better safety standards than you see in lots of other parts of the world. Even in the shopping mall, we weren't allowed to walk through a certain area because they considered that construction area. I'm sure years ago you'd have just sauntered through with equipment being moved around you. And when we did, we were in Cairo finally, you could see that safety standards in terms of scaffolding, PPE, hard hats, boots, safety harnesses, none of that was happening in Cairo.
In Egypt.
In Egypt. Whereas in Qatar, they are operating to a better standard than they were before the award of the tournament.
We don't want to sound like apologists for the Qatar regime, because anyone who tries to sort of say any of these numbers almost gets criticised for being apologists for the Qatar regime. We're not. We went there because we haven't missed an England game for the best part of 20 years that we've been allowed to go to. This is part of our life and part of our holidays. And we want to go there to see the football, to enjoy the cultures, and hopefully by the locals mixing with people like us and from, the rest of the world, they will see a different side to the world.
Yeah, well said. And I mean, I was particularly keen to get a balance from what I've said. I've had a good old pop at Qatar, but to get a balanced view and to get some first-hand experience onto the pod in terms of you guys obviously being over there, you can tell us a bit more about what's happened. So you have done that, which is great. And I think it does at least give... So it certainly gives more weight and a lot more balance, a bit more density to the whole matter, I think. And we should mention, by the way, there have been a couple of deaths as well. Unfortunately, I think there was a guy who was on a forklift truck and he fell off the top of it. It was a bit of an unfortunate death in terms of it wasn't far to fall, but he should have had a safety harness. And I think the Qataris said it wasn't a World Cup tournament death because it was... being handled by an outside company or something, but it was actually the training ground of Saudi Arabia. We could do with, if they were kind of honest a bit more, I think that would be.
I think that is the thing, they've done themselves no favours, and you do have a lack of faith. Stopping that beer two days beforehand was a complete lack of faith. You actually have no, I have no faith in what they tell us. And so, we're not believing what they tell us. The second death was a death on an oil structure, which today I saw reported in the Telegraph, he was actually allegedly struck on the head by his Scottish workmates.
I think having more transparency, having better quality data and actually being able to analyse it and then driving towards, zero injuries, that's what, and until you reach the point of nobody is harmed while doing their job in any way, you haven't got where you need to be on the journey towards, safety and security.
And the week we left, someone sadly, very sadly, was killed at Sizewell B or C nuclear plant in England. And so, industrial accidents do happen. What you do need is, as Janet said, is the transparency of the numbers so that we can trust them or not. And I don't really trust them. I don't trust what they tell us.
And then you put in place the right processes and systems to ensure worker safety.
And sadly, I think the Guardian's headline number was totally misleading, and it's just quoted out of context all the time. There is a number somewhere between the, whatever they said, 3,500 and the 3 that FIFA was saying. And they've now, FIFA are now saying it's about 500, which possibly sounds right, but who knows?
But far too high.
But there should be more transparency on that. And then,
what have you done about it? Mm. How can you stop any other family having someone who doesn't come at home?
Final bit, we'll have a quick break and then quickly go on to the Albion after the break. But just on this section of the pod, one final bit. Despite all the controversy about the building of the stadiums themselves, I have to say, look absolutely stunning. Is it the Al Bayt one that you mentioned earlier that's the one with the Bedouin tent style? Mm. I think you're the right one.
Yeah.
So you went there three times then.
Yes.
Yeah.
And obviously went to the other stadiums as well, or some of the other stadiums. What was your take on it from close up? You mentioned obviously everything was clean and well organised, but I mean, were they breathtakingly impressive? Yeah, they looked different.
They were stunning buildings. That one, you know, not only is it its sort of tent-like appearance from, you know, the outside and the distance, but inside, even the panelling on the ceiling areas is kind of a tent, you know, woven tent effect. Wow. So the traditional textile patterns. So that it was stunning. And then some of the other stadia have, you know, they may be simple inside, but they've got beautiful kind of latticing, you know, framework around them and beautifully lit. So they were, you know, they are things of beauty, actually.
And if you were going to design a stadium, you'd design them like any of those. Because they were quite steep-sided. They weren't too steep, so they didn't feel vertiginous. But they weren't like Wembley with a shallow bowl. You know, if you sat or even stood, you were ahead, above, over the person in front of you. So you could pretty much see, because they were nice, tight stadium, quite straight up on the sides. You know, obviously brand new. The facilities out the back, the toilets, the food, walking round.
The leg room. Great view from every seat. So we had the cheapest category seats all the time.
It was a fantastic
great views.
State of tournament for the TV as well. The 10 o'clock kickoffs and the views of the stadiums, I'm sure, looked fantastic on the telly. And, of course, three of them, England games, were at 7 o'clock UK time, which is perfect for UK telly. And I'm sure that's why they did it.
Hmm.
Just before we do move on, I'm just going to mention the ticket prices in case anyone was sort of interested in ticket prices.
Yeah, please do.
So always get the cheapest ones, because we find that even if you get the more expensive ones, you never get better seats, really. So the cheapest prices for the group games were just about £60.
Hmm.
So for the three group games, £57 the equivalent of. So then for the round of 16, we paid £80. And for the England-France game, it was £172. So it got up quite a lot. And to pay £172 for the cheapest ticket for a final is quite a lot. The semi-final cheapest ticket, £172. And the final, which we had tickets for, conditional tickets, were £504 cheapest.
Whoa.
So it ratcheted up as you went through. So £57 is equivalent, I guess, to a Premier League match for the...
But also, if you went up to the higher price ranges, it's almost three times as much.
Blimey.
So, yeah, so for the Category 3 tickets, the cheapest that we paid £57 for, the top price was £183. So you could pay £183. Mm. And because we go to all the games and we're what they call top cappers, we get first dibs on the tickets, so we always go for the cheapest. So the top price ticket for the final was £1,340. So if you weren't like us regulars who got in there first because of their caps level, you had to go for a Category 2 or a Category 1 ticket just to get in. So the Category 2 tickets for the final were £836 a ticket, and the Category 1, as I said, were £1,340 a ticket. And so... That did put you off going to other games that you weren't particularly interested in.
Yeah.
You know, you could ratchet up a lot of games. Most of the cheap tickets went to the fans from those countries. So if you were trying to look around for tickets for other games, you were paying £200 a ticket, sometimes more. So that did make it expensive if you wanted to do that. And we went to another couple of games. We did get cheaper tickets. And one of the great ones that we saw was, South Korea versus Ghana, so we saw Tarek Lamptey play.
Excellent.
Which was brilliant. Sadly, we were too far away from him to actually encourage him, but it was great to see him play out there.
Great support from the Ghanaian fans.
Yeah.
Really good.
Right. That's good to hear. Excellent.
Right, we also saw Matty Ryan, didn't we?
Yeah, he was playing Australia.
That's right, we've got two or three ex-players as well
as Aaron Moy was playing for Australia.
And so we're back with Chris and Janet for the last part of this podcast, talking about their travails over in Qatar for the World Cup, a tournament which is in just effectively one city, and it's going to go from one extreme to the other next. The next tournament, which I am really not happy about, is going up to 48 teams. And they're talking, in fact, today, Infantino's talking about it being 16 groups of three each, with two from the three qualifying, which sounds like it's just too much, isn't it? And it's going to be... It's stretched over three countries, which probably pretty much would need to be, but it sounds like a bit of chaos. And also Infantino today has announced that there's going to be a 32 club world club championship taking place in 2025, which again is insanity. The guy's an absolute nutter, as far as I'm concerned. Any quick thoughts on that before we move on to another subject?
Well, I think the three teams per group concept is still under discussion, isn't it? I think that was the working model, but subsequent to this World Cup, they're saying, well, actually having four groups or four teams per group makes sense. But I think, you know, the issue is you don't, you know, beyond a round of 16, you don't want, you know, zillions of teams going through to the next.
I think the quality would be diluted. You'll have so many teams, you know, Scotland may even qualify, and it'd be the standard of the games, you know, Scotland against, Peru, they might even lose that, as they do. But the standard, the quality with 48 teams would just be diluted. And also, if they have groups of three, you know, England could fly there all the way to Mexico. We could have two games, and then we could be out and have to fly home again. You know, as a fan, it's not good for fans to have to fly somewhere. But no, Scotland probably would, if they qualified. They'd probably fly there, have two games, then they'd be knocked out. They'd have to fly home.
The teams that do compete, you're going to get one less game. The ones that don't get through a group.
Exactly. This we had three, you know, you're guaranteed three games. You can go for three group games. With groups of three, you'll only get two games.
I guess the flip side is
bigger groups and therefore fewer team, you know, only two from each group proceeding. So why not groups of six?
48 countries is just a nonsense. You know, the 32 is at least divisible to 16 and 8 and 4 and 2 and 1.
Yeah, I mean, it's good it'll get some nations to a tournament they wouldn't normally do. But the point is, you're supposed to be the
qualifications.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. And also, I think it's one extreme to the other in terms of Qatar. Not so much Qatar, but with normal tournaments so far, you'll get people converging into a fairly small area. The whole world converges in one place and you get interaction between fans. You'll know more about that than I will because I've not been to a tournament before. Mm. What you're going to get with this tournament is you're going to get it spread over three pretty large countries, particularly Canada and the US. And it's going to be, you're not going to have that tournament festival feel on anywhere near the same scale because everything's going to be so stretched out. But anyway, we won't dwell on that. Just very quickly on the World Cup then, since the last episode, we've had the semi-finals. Argentina cruised through past Croatia in the end. 3-0, Messi with a penalty to go joint top on the scoring. Alvarez, Manchester City's reserve, with two goals to finish them off. In the other semi-final, Morocco, whose story was brilliant. Obviously, you know, first Arab World Cup, and then you've got an Arab nation, North African nation, who get as far as the semi-finals, which is the first time ever. Ghana nearly did, as we mentioned, with the Suarez incident. But for the first time ever, an African nation did do so. And they gave a pretty damn good account of themselves in the end, losing 2-0 to goals from Hernandez and Mouami. A fantastic, I think some great football on the pitch. Interesting semis. Don't know if you've got any quick views on that. And also on the final, who you think might win it? I think Argentina. I think it's got Messi's name on it, I think. But what do you guys think? France are the favourites, aren't they?
I mean, it should be really evenly balanced, shouldn't it? I think, you know, France has probably got more quality across the whole squad, sorry, McAllister, but but with Messi and McAllister, anything can happen, couldn't it? So Argentina could, you know, it could be their tournament.
Yeah, I must admit, I don't like the antics of the French. You know, I thought Griezmann should have been booked way before he was booked, and I think that would have had a big impact on the game because I think, you know, all these little fouls high up the pitch actually impacted the way that England played a lot. I don't like that, and they did that throughout. And the ref actually seemed to encourage them and condone them in a lot of what went on in that game. So I don't like their antics. We didn't see the final because we were just about to fly home on the semi-final rather on that night. Argentina, I mean, we've been to Argentina and it is a lovely country. We've been there several times. Is it a country that, you know, we're that fond of, we feel that warm about? The only reason I want them to win would be for McAllister, really. Mm-hmm. So it's one of those games. It's a bit like, you know, Crystal Palace playing someone else, Leeds United. You know, you don't really mind who loses, or you wish they both could lose, but.
Yeah, we're really hoping for Morocco v Croatia in the final.
Yeah. Croatia would have been the TV wonder that FIFA deserved, really.
I mean, Morocco, Argentina would have been incredible from the atmosphere point of view, but for me, I'd like Argentina. For the idea that a Brighton player could win the World Cup.
Yeah, I think that's it.
Maybe he plays the key hand in getting a bit. You never know. One shot from outside the area could be the
And McAllister's there on merit for playing with Brighton. It's not like he's a has-been, you know, when he's on his way down and he's sort of, he's dropped in at Brighton on the way through and all his good days are behind him. He's there because he's playing for Brighton and playing well for Brighton. He's at his peak playing for Brighton and he could win the World Cup. So in that sense, I think that would be a fantastic thing for Brighton for us. Let's hope he flies home and we give him both sets of fans giving a guard of honour at Charlton on the whatever day that is. I think that from what I read from Raymond today, that he's likely to stay out there for another week. But wouldn't it be brilliant if he came home and we all just clapped him as he walked around the pitch at Charlton?
That'd be great, especially because I'm not a Saint, so it would have to be the Charlton game for me.
Yeah.
But I would like Messi to win it as well. I think he's the GOAT in terms of wrong spelling, GOTE, greatest of the era, I think. I don't think there's a debate about it, to be honest. Although some might argue on Ronaldo, but I really don't think he's quite on that level, especially proved by this latter day surge that he's had in form. Is he the GOAT, the G-O-A-T? You know, that's for debate forever, isn't it? Because of different eras. But I think one thing that would define him as a player for his career would be for him to win as well. I think he deserves it. I think he's been quite, you see all sorts of geniuses, whether it be Diego Maradona or whether it be a Paul Gascoigne. There seem to be a lot of problems or precociousness attached to players of that ilk. Messi seems to be almost boringly kind of static in the way he goes about his football. I quite like that.
He used to wind up the Dutch though, didn't he?
Oh yeah, just a bit.
Otherwise very grounded.
Yeah.
You could say in Argentina, it is a sort of a great footballing nation. The fans love their football. They are knowledgeable about their football and they're very passionate. So, you know, I think, but the French, they have got quite a lot of nous, haven't they? They may be able to cope with some of the Argentinian antics that we've seen in some games
so far.
So it could be a very good match for each other. A good ref, and may the best team win.
Yeah, whatever you think about that France-England game, the ref was terrible. Whether it affected the game or not, it's irritating to have such poor refereeing at that level of the game. And we really hope that won't be the talking point in the final. Both teams, as you've said there, Janet, they've got the savvy. I think both of them have.
Yeah.
And it's going to be interesting who can negate who in that regard.
Yes.
But it's not a coincidence those two teams made it to the final with a mixture of quality players and nous.
Yes.
And let's see what happens. Moving away from the World Cup, though, unless you've got anything else to spell on that subject, I was going to steer around to the Albion backstories. Now, Chris, you say you've been on before. I can't remember if you mentioned your backstory for Albion supporting, but would you care to divulge it again?
I may have done briefly. Yes. So my first game was actually 1966. I saw Brighton beat Peterborough in October 66, 5-2 it was. Mm. So that was my very first game. And I've been going ever since. I thank my dad, sadly just passed, for taking me to that game. Myself, my sister and he went to that game. And ever since then, we've been hooked. So I was 6 and a bit at the time, maybe nearly 7, I think. And, so what's that? 56, 57 years of supporting the Albion. Now we go to nearly every game when we're not traveling. So home and away, you know, we'll go down to Southampton on Boxing Day. We go to Everton. I think we're going to give the Middlesbrough game a miss because we're going there several times. But that's to complete my 92, which the 92 Football League grounds. And so we're going to go to Fleetwood Town versus QPR FA Cup third round that day. And that will complete my 92. And it takes Janet up to somewhere in the mid-80s. So she's not far behind.
Mm. Right. Okay. So you're almost level with us, Janet. So we might end up signing it off at the same time, perhaps. We'll have to see.
Yeah.
I'm
going to do a bit of a count up. There's sort of a couple of grounds. I'm not sure if I went to the current ground or previous ground that I went to. So I really need to go through my records for that.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And my first Albion game was in 1978 when I was at university and in Southampton. But Chris organised for a group of us to come along to see Brighton play. So I went and saw them versus West Ham. And the West Ham fans weren't very nice. Being pelted by coins and things like that.
West Ham fans, I can't believe it.
But yeah, I still, you know, we continue to go. So, yeah.
Brilliant. So you go back a fair way. You had originally a different affiliation, didn't you, as well?
I did. Well, I'm a West London girl and my family were from within a stone's throw of Stamford Bridge. And my brother went to school there. So the first team I cared for was Chelsea 1970, playing Dirty Leeds in the FA Cup final. And that's when I got interested in football. My dad wasn't into football. My brother was, but not my dad. And he wouldn't let me go to Chelsea because it was too rough. So I started going with my school friends to Brentford as a sort of a early teen. So it's to go there on my own because I could get there under my own steam quite easily. So I used to see Brentford and for a long time we watched Brentford and Brighton in, you know, whatever divisions we were in, you know, pre-kids. But then I did get a chance to go back to Chelsea a few times.
But we've now
as a maturity. But now I threw out all my old Chelsea memorabilia in protest on the recent events.
Not just the Potter stuff, but the Super League as well. Really,
yeah, well, that really upset me. The suggestions of the Super League, and when the kind of billeting of Brighton staff. I've kind of lost patience.
Yeah. And there's actually something in the EU there. Somebody I think has stated that they might be able to protect by law against clubs leaving under EU law. So that might be interesting. That's another little aside. But anyway, yeah, so firm fans for a long time. In terms of the World Cup, is there anyone you've seen you'd like us to sign for either the transfer window coming up or in the summer? I thought the Morocco midfielders, Amra, that's I think a bit too high profile, but his teammate in central mid, the number eight, is it Unahi, I think his name is. Would you like to see us try and get someone like him?
Yeah, I can't say I particularly noticed anyone, because whenever we're there, we're either watching the England players or the Brighton players. I don't know how it worked out that every time a Brighton player played, they seemed to come top of the scores, didn't they? So when Ecuador played, the three top players were always the Brighton players. When Matoma played for Japan, he was the best player. And McAllister even outscored Messi for some of the games. So, you know, I think probably we got the best players there, certainly if you go by the scores that we've got.
Yeah.
Well, it seemed Brighton players did aid success on the pitch. Trossard, Belgium, they kept not playing him. They kept not doing well. They got knocked out. And McAllister, they didn't win with him, not in the team. Of course, he had the shot with the Saudis beating them. And then, of course, as soon as they started playing him as a starter, we got all the way to the final. Coincidence? Probably. No, maybe not. But there we go. So, yeah, I mean, that's pretty much it, I think, so far. The only other thing was any other thoughts about this season and the Albion? Obviously, we've not had you on to talk about it before for this year. There's been the Potter upheaval and, you know, De Zerbi coming in. He's done brilliantly so far, hasn't he, all things considered, I think. Would you agree with that? And how have you found the season overall, guys?
Yeah, I mean, it's been a fantastic season so far. And, you know, I think that De Zerbi hopefully will be an upgrade on Potter. And that we'll love him. We love him as a character. He seems to do and say the right things and he shows the right sort of passion and stuff. His playing style is quite nerve-wracking. You know, it is pass it out from the back in the extreme.
And suicide passes.
Yeah, and so far I don't think they've actually made a mistake yet and given it away that's cost them a goal, but at times it looks, you're sort of, heart's in your mouth really while you're watching some of the passing going on. But they've got away with it. But it does make for an entertaining game. I mean, it was fantastic to beat Chelsea. And then, you know, the away win at Arsenal in recent times, disappointing the last game, but hopefully, you know, we'll be back on it against Charlton and Southampton away.
And the players look like they're having fun, don't they, on the pitch? And certainly De Zerbi seems to have respect for the fans as well as, you know, what's going on the pitch, which is really lovely to see. in some ways it's, you know, a shame we've had this hiatus for the World Cup and that, you know, we've not been able to continue the progress that we've seen. But I think I've got faith that he'll get them back on, you know, performing as they should. Yeah,
and, you know, I shouldn't really dwell on those that have gone, but, you know, reading what Cucurella has just said this week and also what Potter said recently, I mean, good riddance, really. And, you know, I'm pleased that we've got the ones now who want to be here.
Absolutely. And I went to the, there was a fans forum invite, for supporter groups and I was able to attend that. And that was brilliant. I mean, I just love the guy even more, deserving now. He's, but Paul Barber seemed a lot more strangely relaxed and more jovial. De Zerbi, I think, was brilliant. Interpreter, who's one of his assistants, was brilliant as well. And David Weir was excellent value. That was a good event. But De Zerbi, I think, has just completely sold me now, on De Zerbi ball and De Zerbi persona. It's great.
Yeah.
Long may it last.
Indeed. And on that note, it seems a good way to sign off. You guys have got to go. I've got to go as well. So, we'll leave it there, but it's been brilliant to have you both on. Thanks, Janet. Thanks, Chris, for joining us. We'll maybe get you on again in the future. But in the meantime, let's hope we can all enjoy the resumption of Premier League football now and League Cup. No doubt I'll see you at the League Cup for the Charlton game, which is next up for the Albion.
Oh, yeah, we're all round to Peter's house. Should we advertise that?
Yes, Peter, my co-host, is having a load of
open house with hospitality, I hear.
Yeah, all 8,000 of us going round, I think.
Yeah. Well, we have to do the ticket checks there.
Yeah, I know. No one's got their ticket yet. This could be chaos, couldn't it? Oh dear, never mind. Well, on that note then, thank you again to Janet and Chris, and I'll sign out in the usual way by saying, stand or fall.
Stand or fall, up the Albion.
Up the Albion. And in fact, I do have to add the epilogue to this episode, having now seen the final on the Sunday, 3 o'clock kickoff, which went to, in the end, extra time and penalties, and Argentina triumphed. So, Senor Alexis Mac-Allister Esquire is a world champion, a current Brighton and Hove Albion player, and a world champion. How proud are we all about that, and how happy we are for him. A fantastic achievement. It was, without doubt, Messi's final World Cup. He's already said so himself. He's 35 years old. It definitely was always going to be his final World Cup. And for a while, it looked like they may not make it. Some other good teams in there, Brazil, France, maybe even England could have challenged. But when it came down to it, they got to the final and they absolutely battered France for about 79 minutes. France were bent over a table having their bottom spanked. But no, in the end, out of the blue, they concede a penalty, which Mbappe buries, to square the golden boot scoring, by the way, up onto 6 each with Messi at that stage. But then he goes ahead on the golden boot just 90 seconds later after a mistake by none other than Lionel himself. A breakaway move and boom, 90 seconds gone, out the blue, France are back in it, it's 2-2. It goes to extra time. What happens? Well, could it be the proverbial Hollywood script or an Argentinian fairy tale? Could Messi be the one to get a winning goal? I was thinking of that. I was thinking maybe even Alexis Mac-Allister could become one of the most famous players in Argentina's history by scoring a winner. Maybe it could be him. But the script seemed to be written for Messi, and sure enough, there was a breakaway, a marginal onside call, and Messi prodded the ball over the line from close range. It was cleared by a defender just afterwards, so it was already over the line. He went running off to the side of the touchline, right near all the Argentina fans, the major bulk of them, and he was buried under an absolute pile of Argentina players for what seemed like minutes on end as they celebrated what surely must be a spectacular and complete and utter fairy tale ending to the match. No, it wasn't. Because what happened was, Mbappe took back that golden boot. He equalised again because Argentina gave away a penalty and he buried it. Mbappe put that, and later on in the penalty shootout, his third penalty, all three of them went to Mbappe's left, the goalkeeper's right, interestingly. Anyway, all three of them were converted. In terms of the open play, that second penalty of his made it a hat-trick. He is only the second player, I think this is right, the second player in history to score a World Cup final hat-trick. The last, of course, being Jeff Hurst when he was on the winning side for England in 66. This time, Mbappe has conspired to score a hat-trick in a World Cup final and not be on the winning side because they went and lost the shootout. But you've got to hand it to France. They didn't give up, did they? They were dead and buried for almost all the game. And you know what football's like? One chance, one moment can turn things. The psychology, not completely, but to a fairly large degree, had changed. And yet Argentina battled back and then survived another late worry as they had the equaliser in open play. And it wasn't even over there, because then France, on a breakaway, had a one-on-one with the goalkeeper. Martinez, he's a real shithouser, but he is a cracking goalkeeper. And he saved one-on-one with his feet, with his left foot. And not only that, there was a counter-attack off the back of it, went up the other end, and Argentina had a chance, but they headed way off target. Well, either way round could have been an even more dramatic end to open play normal time. As it was, it went to a shootout, 4-2 in the end. McAllister had been substituted very late into extra time, so he wasn't one of the penalty shootout takers. But, you know, the job was done. Messi scored his goal. And I think what you have to say, two or three things about this match. First of all, it was an excellent final, played in the right spirit. There wasn't too many shenanigans going on. There wasn't too much physicality, which was a fear people had. These two sides are savvy and know how to get to finals and win. That wasn't the case. Secondly, the referee was absolutely excellent. Forget his name offhand, but Polish ref, bald head, looks a bit like the classic Italian ref, Colina. But he is a fantastic ref. He was worthy of the World Cup final and was superb. It's always a joy to be able to praise a referee. Doesn't happen often enough. And thirdly, it was, I think, a match where you could call a joint Man of the Match award for three players. One of them has to be Mbappe. He scored a hat-trick. Even though he was quiet for most of the game, he still had a huge influence on how the drama played out at the end. Messi, who scored two and was absolutely sensational, not least in the build-up to the second goal, where he received a flick ball on from McAllister. He flicked it deliciously with the outside of his boot. The ball was then played from a right-wing side forwards. I think it was De Paul, I can't remember who it was. Played forwards, and McAllister, who as soon as he passed to Messi had made a run, ran onto the ball, was through, nearly on goal. He had a defender bearing down on him. The angle's maybe not so favourable. And he did the right thing and passed across to the unmarked Di Maria. And Di Maria buried it with aplomb to make it 2-0. That was the earlier chance in the game. And I think that, as well as Mbappe, Messi and McAllister are joint men of the match in this game. I think that would only be the fair way to call it. And not just because I'm an Albion fan. I genuinely think that that is the best call on that score. So, the fairy tale did happen. Not quite in the most perfect way. Maybe Messi would have liked that goal to make it 3-2 to have been the winner, I'm sure. But I'm pretty sure he'll be happy enough. The fans went mad. The look of joy in his face. The camaraderie amongst the team. And to see a Brighton player celebrating with a winner's medal, kissing a trophy that is the most famous football trophy in world football. And to be celebrating with those fans, what a joyous occasion for both Messi and for McAllister, and of course for all of the other players in that team. But I'm delighted that what I believe to be the greatest player of all time, I think he edges it over Maradona, because he did it much more consistently in his 17-year career than Maradona did. Maradona had fits and starts. He only had two sensationally good years and one or two other pretty good years. He won a Scudetto, he won some other trophies, but really Messi, in terms of trophies, in terms of consistency, he's right up there. And now he's got that World Cup trophy in the cabinet as well. You have to say that there's a compelling case for him to be the greatest of all time. And anybody who's got any slightest notion that Ronaldo is in the discussion is absolutely off their heads, because he doesn't really compare. He's an astonishingly good footballer, but he's not in the same league as Messi. And Messi now has the World Cup to brag about as well, if he was that sort of a person. But he isn't really, is he? So, a superb day's football. It was, you have to say, begrudgingly, because of where it's held and all the controversies around the tournament, begrudgingly you might call it, it's been a fantastic football tournament on the pitch. One of the best. I don't think it was necessarily the best, as Infantino, of course, was all too quick to say. But he's talking about the tournament organisation as well, though, anyway, in his case. But it was one of the best tournaments, I think. Some great shocks. Japan's comeback from behind wins. Saudi Arabia shocking the eventual champions. Argentina coming from behind themselves to win that game. Who knew how that was going to turn out at the time? Some other fantastic matches, and we've got what's probably the best final of all time to talk about. It finished in the end 3-3 in normal time, 4-2 on penalties to Argentina. Congratulations to them. I guess this does mean that Ali Mack isn't going to be back quite as soon as we might have hoped, as they'll be off celebrating. Apparently they're going back to Argentina for a procession and a few days of celebrating there. So I don't think he's going to quite be there at Charlton away on Wednesday. But anyway, had to add this epilogue because it was a sensational time, and I think we can all say we're proud of him. And to say Brighton have a player who played in a World Cup final, let alone won it, is just almost too much to believe, really. And to hear Guy Mowbray, the excellent BBC commentator, flagging our names up on a number of occasions, talking about Brighton and Hove Albion, talking about Seagulls fans must be pinching themselves and all this sort of thing. Well, I certainly was, because it's almost unbelievable. But it happened. It happened, folks. We have a world champion in our midst. And the reception for him when he comes back, I'm sure, will be truly phenomenal. Anyway, that rounds up this episode. Thanks again to Chris and Janet for joining me in the earlier part of it. And thanks again to Peter, as always, of course. I'm my co-host, with a couple of our earlier roving, ground-hopping segments that we had at the beginning of the episode. Our next one will be probably with a special guest. Not quite sure what's happening at the moment. But until then, it's back to domestic football. Albion away at Charlton. I'll be there. We might do a match day special. In fact, we probably will. So that actually will be the next episode. And then, of course, we've got the Boxing Day visit to Southampton and Arsenal coming to town on New Year's Eve. Those are the upcoming fixtures. So I'll speak to you next time from the Charlton game. Until then, stand or fall, up the Albion.
Sports Social Podcast Network.
Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered Chumbacasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby, mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa, take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to Chumbacasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.